Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome. This is Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history. And I'm your host, Karen Peter. Today's episode is a collaboration with Community of Christ Historic Sites as we interview the presenters from the 2021 Historic Sites Fall Lecture Series. All of these lectures can be found at the historicsitesfoundation.org website. Now, our guests today are Eva Erickson and Kirsten. Now, I need to ask pronunciation. Do I pronounce the J, Kirsten?
Jeske.
Jeske. All right. Thank you. And Kirsten Jeske. They are the lecturers, the partnering lecturers for the Historic Sites Lecture, The Church Behind the Iron Curtain. Now, for many of our listeners, their political awareness comes from post-Berlin Wall and post-Iron Curtain. So this will be a wonderful exploration for people, for our younger listeners who aren't familiar with some of that terminology. So Kirsten Jeske was born into the church, and as the daughter of the leader of the church in East Germany at that time, church was a big part of her life. She worked full-time for Community of Christ from 1994 to 2005 and served as a president of 70 for Europe and Africa from 2000 to 2007. She's now an ordained high priest and serves as the ministry coordinator for Norway, where she resides, and she's joining us from Oslo today. Eva Erickson grew up in East Germany as well, was raised in the Lutheran Church, and joined the RLDS, now Community of Christ, Church in 1991 after experiencing children's and youth camps. Eva met her husband in the U.S. and lived there for many years before returning to Germany in 2005. She's a member of the Standing High Council and serves as the ministry coordinator for Germany. So welcome to both of you, and thank you for joining us here at Project Zion podcast. So I'd like to begin with just a little bit of basic information, kind of the when and how did the church originally arrive in Germany, and kind of who were the first members or locations of the church in Germany. So let's begin there. Kirsten, Eva?
Great, I'll take that one. I did a little bit of research, and I mostly based my information on a seminary paper that Michael Menzer wrote. It was his final project when he did seminary. It's called How It All Started, and that pretty much tells the story of the beginning of the church in Germany, as well as a history, church history in Germany by Gerhard Schöpke. So the way that they're telling it is that there were some early attempts in 1841 for missionary work in Germany, when Orson Hyde was on a mission to Palestine and stopped over in Germany. It wasn't very fruitful, so there was nothing happening then. Then the RLDS Church again tried to send missionaries in 1872, but again, not much success there. And then there was a renewed effort in 1904 when a Klaus Jönk was appointed missionary to Germany. Jönk was from Germany originally. He had immigrated to the US. He was fluent in German, obviously. And that was important because this is before Google Translate. It was, in fact, a problem for a while to recruit more help for him because it was hard to find priests who that spoke German. So in any case, Jönk came back to Germany, started the mission in Germany, and went back, obviously, to the north of Germany where he came from. And so his first activities were in the Hamburg area. And he was joined by another missionary called John Becker. And so in Hamburg, they baptized three people, but these three people afterwards, there's not much mention of them. So I wouldn't call them any of the important members really in that time. But then Jönk moved on to Berlin, where he met a Alexander Kippe. And Kippe was apparently at that time a member of the LDS Church. But that was an accident, believe it or not. So I thought that was a funny story. Kippe's brother lived in Australia at that time and had contact with the RLDS Church and told Alexander about it, and they went back and forth, and he was all excited about it. And so Alexander wanted to be baptized, in this RLDS church as well. But in Germany, there was no RLDS church at that time. So he got all mixed up and accidentally joined the Utah church. I thought that was a funny story. So, but anyway, because of the brother in Australia, the name of Alexander Kippe was given to Jürg in his missionary work. I guess he went back to church headquarters and asked for names and references and who to possibly meet. And so in 1906, incidentally, on April 6th, the day of the birthday of the church, Jürg baptized Kippe, Alexander Kippe, and his wife and the mother-in-law in Berlin. And Kippe turned out to be a pretty important person for the church. I would say he's the first really important member. He did some missionary work, and he also translated the Book of Mormon into German, first translation for our church. Yeah. Then Jürg, so the missionary, moved on to about 2 hours south of Berlin into the town of Altdöbern, where he was to meet Smolny, Johann Smolny. And Smolny is a really important name that you will hear anytime you talk to older members. So Smolny and his wife lived in Altdöbern, and they were Lutheran at that time, or initially, but they weren't really satisfied with the Lutheran church. And so they joined the Baptist church, but that didn't really make them happy either. They had questions, in particular questions about the Holy Spirit and the structure of the New Testament church. And he felt that the Baptist church couldn't satisfactorily answer their questions, and so his questions. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of a story there. I don't want to make it too long, but the short version of it is he had a friend close to where he lives, and that friend's daughter moved to Kansas City. And so in Kansas City, she also met the RLDS church, whatever. Apparently in the conversation, the friend and Smolny figured out that some of his questions might possibly be answered by this church. And they wrote back to the daughter to Kansas City and asked about it. And she responded that, yes, there was a missionary coming to Germany. So this is how it happened, that Jürg came to Altdöbern, met with Smolny, but they did not get along. They had fierce arguments. They just didn't like each other, apparently. And it didn't look so good. And Smolny thought, okay, this is not it after all. I'm just going to turn my back and go. And then how it happens sometimes, there is a memory of Gertrud Orban, the daughter of Johann Smolny. And in her memory, she says that Smolny had a dream before Jürg turned his back and left again. Smolny had a dream. And in this dream, among other things, he was taught that the person who would come as a messenger to him would be a shoemaker. And wouldn't you know it, next day he asked Jürg what his profession was, and it was a shoemaker. So he was convinced this was the right person, this was the right church, this was the right answer. And he joined the church, or he was baptized in 1907. And yeah, those are the beginnings. The three main areas of activity of the church were then Hamburg, Berlin, and Altdöbern. Altdöbern, incidentally, is very close to Großrechen, where one of our big churches is right now. So that is all one area there. And yeah, Kippe and Smolny, I would say, were the most important leaders in that time, beside the U.S. missionaries that came. And like I said, Smolny's daughter is called Gertrud Orban. And for those who have listened to our lecture the other day, Gertrud Orban married Alfred Orban, or Gertrud Smolny at the time married Alfred Orban, and Alfred Orban happened to be the main leader in the East German church. And so this is how we can make a good transition to our lecture, because our lecture, of course, only covered East Germany and only covered the years of 1961 through 1989. And so, yeah, Alfred Orban was the most important person in that time. So I think that was a good transition now.
I enjoy all of the small bits in that description of the church coming to Germany, whether it's the disagreements that people had or the dream. But my favorite is that it really depended on the young woman going to Kansas City. And we forget sometimes the role that women played in the church before women were ordained. So thank you for sharing that particular piece of information. So now we have a bit of a foundation on how the church arrived in Germany. And as you said, your lecture focuses on East Germany. during the time of the Iron Curtain. So if you will, tell us a bit what that was like and how that affected what was happening with churches in general, and particularly with RLDS Church as it was on its journey to become Community of Christ.
I can start on that one. Like in general, in East Germany, church life was not looked upon very favorably. There was really the slogan from Karl Marx, religion is opium of the people. So, and with that, they really, the government or the state officials tried to ridicule anything that was came together with religion and had something to do with believing. They even tried to get rid of the Christian vocabulary. Some ridiculous attempts, like in Germany, the German word for Christmas has nothing to do with Christianity, Weihnachten. But then we would decorate before Christmas, for example, with angels. So they tried to come up with a new name for angel and renamed it in German, Vorweihnachtliche Flügelfigur, which translated means pre-Christmas figure with wings. Really rather weird. So but they just tried to get rid of all the religious parts in the language, and I think they did a pretty good job trying to rule it as much out as possible. When I was studying like in the late 80s, we had East Germany behind the Iron Curtain already for 20 years. And several of my fellow students wouldn't really have a lot of knowledge of the Christian story, Bible stories. I remember once a fellow student got a video cassette of a movie, and since it was an English one, everybody got excited and thought, oh, we should watch this. And it was Monty Python's Life of Brian. And there were two of us who could sit there and laugh. And I knew the other one was Christian, and I and all the others, they couldn't laugh. They said, what is this? They didn't have the references. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Anyway, this is, now I'm getting carried away. But so they really tried to.
So, Kirsten, can I stop just 1 second? Because mm-hmm. that's an important point that you just made about cultural understanding. Sometimes church people think that everybody has the same cultural understanding about Bible references or Christian mm-hmm. references, mm-hmm. but you're talking about living in a culture where all of those references are no longer.
Right, right.
So making connections with people is even more difficult.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Really
That's important.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so all this, obviously, our education in regard to history, politics, Christian heritage was very biased. But otherwise, I would say the education we got in school was very good. We had good education generally in sciences, music, sport, languages. And that came in quite handy in our church. Lots of musical ministry, and also being able to communicate then in English, which was often the second foreign language we had to learn. From fifth grade on, we all had to learn Russian in school. That was mandatory. But then if you wanted to go on to high school, you had to have a second language, and it usually was English. So that helped us also in communicating with the World Church. So religion was not encouraged. We knew we were watched when we went to church, or because we went to church. So we started to get really careful in what we talk about and to whom. You were not sure whom you could trust. Once you developed friendships, then they got really deep, and there were very strong bonds that developed. I mean, now I'm over 50 years old now and have been living in Norway for over 20 years, but my real friends are still in Germany from that time. There's some rather unusual bonds that developed, and it just
found us together in a rather unusual way. So, yeah. And there was also a large solidarity among the members. I would say most of the members we had in East Germany did not have too much, but they all shared very generously whatever they had. Very gladly invited, used for weekends to stay. We stayed with different families. The host would even sleep for the weekend in the car, leave us their house. So some really good stories and very, very good memories. So life was very simple. I think the message of the church fit very well into this situation. Everybody could get involved as much as possible, as much as they wanted to. Also, and one positive thing about the East German society was really that men and women were rather equal. I mean, most of the women worked full time. So they had really equal rights in the society at large. So that also meant that it was a rather fruitful ground when ordination for women came along, even though it did take some time until it got started. It was 1989. The first woman got ordained in the spring of 1989, Sigrid Spring from Dresden. She was the first woman in East Germany. And then in October of 89, another young woman and me got ordained in Großregen.
So Kirsten, can you tell us a little bit about a kind of the role of women in the congregation prior to ordination? If the culture was such that men and women had a certain level of equality, how did that translate into congregational life before women were ordained?
We did have women's group, women's leaders. They would be involved in doing readings, prayings publicly. Yeah, I mean, there wasn't an official role in the priesthood, but also getting the children together and the women together. Yeah.
Okay. So still very active, very prominent mm-hmm. in the congregation.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. Eva, do you want to add?
Yeah, maybe one thing to add. So from about 1980, obviously the same situation that was in 1961 was not as in 1989, you know, so there was a development even within East Germany. 1961 was very, what Kirsten said in the beginning about churches being, so bad for society and everything, that was very strong in 61, but it kind of sort of weakened and weakened, I think, towards the end, maybe. But most of all, churches in general, not just our church, churches in general, became safe spaces, particularly for people that were dissenters, I think is what you call it, right? Like people that are, that don't agree with the government. The Protestant church, incidentally, already started a peace movement that didn't just have to do with tearing the wall down, something like that. It was more general, but they had an annual event called a peace decade, decade meaning 10 days, not 10 years. So always in November, I think around probably had to do with the World War One annual event. So they had this peace movement going already. And so then when towards the end of East Germany, there was a lot of opposition to the government, these opposition groups were able to meet in churches and kind of hook on to the peace movement that was already there. And so churches grew for once, because people felt, well, if I can't agree with the government and I can't say it anywhere because I'm not safe to say it in public, well, in churches I can say it. So people would actually go to church more because it was an opposition movement. For us as Community of Christ or RDS Church in that time, I think for us it was the beginning of ecumenical work that wasn't even declared as that in that time. Maybe a bit later. Sure. Yeah, but young people, for instance, I remember being at a youth gathering in Leipzig, and that happened to be, it must have been a Monday, because we went to a Monday demonstration, and the Monday demonstrations were the big thing in the last maybe 2 or 3 years of East Germany. And so we would kind of hook into these existing activities of other churches. I remember we went to Jena, a city in southern East Germany, with an American friend of ours who happened to study in East Germany. Don't know how that happened, but it did happen. But we went to a demonstration there. So we kind of learned that even though there was still this went through church feeling, and that's, you know, when I got to know the church in the 80s, I definitely was told that it was the one true church, but still we were able to open ourselves to other movements, other Christian movements. And so I think I would contribute that to the situation in East Germany. We wouldn't have been quite so open to others if we didn't have the necessity, because that was where we were safe. That was where we could talk with others that had also anti-government feelings, or at least pro-Christian feelings, which you couldn't voice anywhere else. But then I think after our church got officially recognized in 84, mm-hmm. That's also when our church leaders took part officially in ecumenical meetings with other churches. So that's when things became more official. But I think what I'm trying to say is that in an official way, but also unofficial way for us as young people, this was the beginning of ecumenical work. And I think that's awesome. I think that is a very early time for our church to start that.
So I'm seeing a thread through your comments, Kirsten and Ava. You started with these early figures, and I think it was 1906, 1907, and is it Smorny? Is that the name of the
family?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that family was looking for was evidence of the Holy Spirit and evidence of the church functioning as a New Testament church. So if we jump ahead to what I've heard now, Kirsten, you explained experiencing the church in a way that was very much the New Testament church, where people cared for one another, were perhaps isolated because of religious beliefs, and so had to develop deep level of trust, share with one another, offer hospitality to one another, which are all indicators, if we read Acts, of the early church, the Holy Spirit expressing itself through that kind of Christ-centered hospitality, but not forgetting the critical element of Christianity, which is to challenge political systems, which is what you're describing, which in the United States would make people crazy. But what you're describing is that a youth camp making the decision to go to a Monday demonstration, which was a political demonstration, that joining of the Christian concept of challenging oppressive political systems, all of that is an expression of the early church. So I don't know if Smorny experienced that in 1907, but the legacy of the church in East Germany certainly experienced it and expressed it.
Just another thought I had, I think it's a fine line. When we actually were able to get officially registered as church, it was 1984. And the question was, well, why did we get the recognition? Why was the government allowing us to officially meet? And the answer was, because you are not dangerous for us. Mm-hmm. So I think they knew very well where we were and what we stood for, and knew that we did not openly challenge mm-hmm. the government. Mm-hmm. So at least at that point, it was safe, or they thought it was safe to recognize us as church. But then also, of course, yeah, the development in the late 90s, before the wall came down, just many, many things happened in society yeah. and in the churches. And then
late 80s.
Yeah. and then we also became more open and taking part in the Monday prayers and demonstrations that would also ask for freedom in the country.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous. So, Before I want to get to some who were some of the leaders during that time, during this later time period. But before I do, I just wanted to ask, did the church experience a difference after 1989? Was there a difference in in how the church was expressed or how you gathered? In other words, did the sense of the kind of the end of the Iron Curtain, did it change how the church expressed itself?
I don't know. It changed for sure because we all scattered. At least, yeah. the young people, the core group that we talked about in the presentation, we all scattered into different parts of the world. Yeah. So for a bit, there might have been a vacuum, but maybe not. I don't know. But the expression of the church didn't really change, I would say. I would think we still stood for the same thing we stood for before. Mm-hmm.
Is there still an ecumenical aspect to the church in Germany?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Different congregations do different things. And, we are not officially part of what you would call the NCC, I think, in the US. So the German equivalent, simply because we don't have the manpower for anybody to go there right now. But on a local level, we have collaborated with other churches. And actually on the national level, we had a few like workshops and gather or meetings with the Protestant church, for instance. And so I think that is definitely still going on.
One thing that happened right after the wall came down was that people were allowed to travel. Before, we were not allowed to travel outside of East Germany, or we could travel to the east, but not to the west. So people used their summer vacation for family gatherings, family camps, youth camps, children camps. And once they could travel, then they used their vacation to travel to other places. And it was more difficult to gather the people. That was one thing that changed right in the very beginning. But it was also good for us to experience really that we are part of a bigger church, that we could take part in church gatherings in the Netherlands, in the British Isles, or even the US. Yeah. So it had ups and downs.
I agree.
So who were some of the church leaders during this transition time, the later part, let's say from the late 70s to 80s?
It was my father, Manfred Jeske. He was the leader of the church in East Germany at that time. He was a 70, and he had two counselors, Joachim Schöne from Dresden in the south and Siegfried Fillinger from the north. And especially Joachim Schöne had lots of talents and was really a driving force getting the church organized, also organizing youth camps, family camps, and other activities. And
we want to make sure here at Project Zion that we mention people's names and thank them for the efforts that they've made to continue the church in different places. Do you have any favorite stories or anecdotes or memories from that period of time that maybe don't fit in the historical consideration, but that are important for us to, would be good for us to hear?
Yeah, so a few people that we didn't mention in our lecture because they were not East German leaders, were people that came into East Germany. We mentioned Tom and Erling Kempe, for instance, and we have to really recognize that I wonder how that was for them. They came from the West and they went into this weird, closed-off place, East Germany, and it must have been scary at times when they came anyway. So one of the people that came was Jack Kirkpatrick. He was the apostle for Europe and Africa, I think, in that time. And I vividly remember him visiting with his wife once in a while, but also just him alone, would attend family camps and come to like special gatherings. And it must have been Kerstin's ordination, I would say, because I think it was a month before the war came down. So probably beginning of October of 1989, he was in Großrehchen attending the ordination. And I remember sitting in Kerstin's parents' living room with Jack and a few others. And it was his last evening. He was going to leave again next day. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to miss you. And now when are we going to see you again? Do you have plans to come to East Germany again? And he said to me, next time we see each other, it will be in the US. And I said, ha ha, nice joke. I mean, whatever you're talking about, you know, that was a month before the war came down. And I talked with him about a couple of years ago about the experience. And I said, how would you have possibly known that the war was coming down? And he said, well, in the outside world, we could see the signs, you know, if you looked at the way things were going. But for us inside the bubble, you know, in East Germany, it was absolutely unexpected. When on the 9th of November, my dad said the wall fell, I said, nice joke, what's the next one? It was just unbelievable. And so for Jack to tell me a month before it happened, the next time we see each other in the US, which wasn't true, we didn't see each other next time in the US, but point being, the wall would go down and at some point you could come to the US, that was just unbelievable.
That's very interesting. I remember watching as the wall came down, and for you to share that from within, you didn't see those signs. So it was an immediate transition. Yeah, whereas for the West, bang. Watching all along. That's very similar, I think, to a lot of people who are experiencing a faith transition right now, who have had kind of their belief system crumble immediately. Whereas in Community of Christ, we have had decades of kind of making, developing new understandings and opening ourselves to new ideas. And this is an interesting illustration of what that feels like. How did, not just how did the church in East Germany stay alive in that kind of climate, because that's a profoundly difficult climate for a religious organization to navigate, but what kind of impact did that tenacity and persistence have on the rest of the church after the wall came down? You had a completely different experience in East Germany than the rest of the church in Germany. How did that affect you, or how did it affect the church and the rest of Germany when the wall came down?
Well, I guess we should start with the fact that Alfred Urban, I guess, is the one name I would name, who made the conscious decision to stay in East Germany. Conscious decision. I mean, he had the chance of, in the 50s, still, you were able to go to the West, move there, and many people did. And I think Alfred sort of knew what was coming up. And anyway, he was already older, and people that were above a certain age that weren't, let's say, valuable to East Germany anymore, you know, like retired people, for instance, they could freely travel to the West. He could have gone pretty much any time, and he decided to stay in the East together with his wife. Their children ended up in the West, and they just didn't follow. So I think that alone made a big impression on people. He was a very strong leader also. We shouldn't forget that. But for somebody to consciously make that decision, I think that's a pretty good statement there. Churches in general were not forbidden. I take that back. The Protestant church and the Catholic church were not forbidden. Our church at some point, I think all of our congregations at some point separately, were not allowed to meet in the 50s at some for a while there. But then by 61, definitely, they were all allowed to meet again. So when I say the churches were not forbidden, it was kind of I wonder if the East German government just didn't know what to do. They didn't know forbid or not forbid, you know. So the big churches, they never did forbid, but ours at times, well, our congregations couldn't meet. But anyway, so by the 60s, they were allowed to meet, but it was more, I don't know, it wasn't secret at all, but it was just unwanted. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think you hear so many stories where in a harsh environment, faith grows. And I think that's true for East Germany also. I mean, it was a harsh environment in a sense of being observed and you know, the Stasi wanting to know everything about your life. It was, in a sense, also a harsh environment, in a sense of a very simple life. I mean, we, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know which way I want to put it, we were able to watch West German television. We could see what's in the stores there. We could see the advertisement for whatever there is. And then we went to our own stores and we had maybe two kinds of cheese and I don't know, we all wear the same clothes. You know, we had enough, we did not starve, but it was by far no luxury. It was by far no colorful, you know, what we could see on TV and we couldn't have it. And that also, I think you can describe as a harsh environment. It's, mm-hmm. it's unfair. It's an unfair system, you think, you know. And I think under those circumstances, that's when faith grows. That's when people move together closer. That's when the community grows together closer. And so I think that is something that for sure stayed in the church in East Germany, even after the war came down.
Kirsten, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I just agree. And actually, it reminds me of a saying of a young man who joined our youth camps just shortly before the war came down. He started attending and he called himself an atheist. And he had the saying, es geschieht nichts Gutes, außer man tut es. So there's nothing good happening unless you do it. And he got really very much involved. And I think that's, you just had to, I mean, you couldn't wait for anybody to do things for yourself. You just had to get going yourself. And I mean, he is now the chairman of today's church association in Germany. And so you just, I mean, if you wanted to get things done, we had to do them ourselves. And mm-hmm. that's something we learned early on. And I think really we were given a lot of freedom and the leaders trusted us and mentored us and allowed us to do things. We prepared worship services and we had youth camps, which we organized on our own and really learned a lot in doing things. And yeah.
So I think to clarify that the ask that Kirsten talks about is the young people. So this is people that are not ordained, people that were barely 18, 19 maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, just really a group of young people. And I think that is what's, when we look back now, what we find so amazing is that we did things by ourselves because we wanted to. Nobody took us by our hands. It was, we wanted to. And in that wanting to, I think leaders recognized there is something going there and let us do things, gave us freedom, allowed us to do things. And I think that's just, yeah, amazing.
Absolutely. So, what are some of the maybe key learnings or major impacts that you feel that the church in Germany has brought to the global church? Do you see any trends or ideas that you can connect to your experience in the church in East Germany?
Well, I would name the concept of friendship evangelism, really, because you had to be so careful about what you say to whom in East Germany. And you wouldn't just talk about church to whoever you meet. So it really meant that you became close friends first and trying to establish friendships. And then you talk about the gospel. And this proved to be a good tool. It worked well for us. And I think that's something that's really, something that can be learned, that missionary work is possible, even in these circumstances, by the way of friendship evangelism.
Building those authentic relationships with people.
Right.
Yeah. Regardless of where it takes them, even if it takes them to being the leader of the church association in Germany, still having those relationships. Absolutely. I wanted to ask each of you, as we begin to conclude our conversation here, how has your experience growing up in the church in Germany, in East Germany, and joining the church as a young person, how has that shaped your personal discipleship? How has that shaped you as a disciple? So Kirsten, we'll start with you.
Can Eva go first?
Eva, do you want to go first?
I can do that. So, like I said, I was part of the Lutheran church when I grew up. My parents were not very active, but they were active enough to send us, to my sister and me, to now they called it like something like church school. It wasn't Sundays. It was some one day during the week, and you would go as a kid and with your peer group, with your age group, have a Christian education. But then I got, because of my neighbors being the Urbans, Gertrud and Alfred, they invited my sister and me to church camps. And so that's when I started to go to Community of Christ. And initially I did both. I did both Lutheran Church and Community of Christ. And so what really impressed me was that several things. But one thing was the family-like atmosphere. That, you know, I was a teenager, and teenagers have a hard time with their parents, that kind of thing. But I was really, I was impressed how accepted I was, how my opinion was accepted with the adults in the church. You know, I was allowed to call them by their first name. Okay, that's not very German. You are very formal sometimes. So that was a cool thing. But also, I mean, I like in Kerstin's home, I felt like I was one of their daughters sometimes, you know, and in the homes of other friends that I went to, I was just accepted for who I was. The other thing was how I was able to be involved. And in a Lutheran church, I was a spectator, I would say. I was, you sit in the pew and somebody up there does something, apart maybe from the Christmas play or some special activities. But on an every Sunday level, you're just observing. Whereas in Community of Christ, from the beginning on, I was asked to do things, and not just me, everybody. I was just part of it before I was a member, and way before I was a member. You know, I mean, if it was reading something, if it was making music, if it was, we as a youth organized whole worship services that, you know, that we offered to the church, and it was absolutely accepted. It wasn't like, ah, you little kids or you young people. Even though it was a fairly stiff society in that time still, I think, but that was just really impressive to me, the way that we were allowed to be part of it all. You were just part of church. You're not just observing priesthood or not, you know, that the discipleship of all people, that I think that is something that was really cool. Yeah, and the last thing, of course, the peace theme. I mean, I was into peace anyway because of the peace movement in the Lutheran church that I had started going to. And then to go to a children's camp, and you have the one of the activities was to make a plaster seal of the church, and you painted it, and it had the word peace on it, and it had the symbolization of peace through the lamb and the lion, and I mean, yeah, the kid and the lion and the lamb, I guess, too. But that was just super impressive to me that a church would have that as their symbol. So out of that, yeah, I mean, I was definitely a different person as a kid. You are different, obviously, but also because of joining this church, it shaped me, it molded me, it helped me develop my discipleship and my leadership skills through these camps. It was just life-changing, I would say.
Thank you, Eva. Kerstin, did that give you enough of a breather that...
Well, I just realized it was a dumb thing to let her go first because she said most of it.
Sorry.
So, yeah, it's a lot of this is just true for me too. I mean, I really enjoyed growing up with an extended church family, enjoyed having all ages around. We had, yeah, old people, young people. Actually, that's something I realized when I went to Braceland. At first I thought, oh wow, so many young people in church. But then after a while, well, but where are the old people? And we are the children. So and just to recognize the worth of all persons, and that we were all really an important part of the church, and everybody had something to contribute. And yeah, I would just say the worth of all person was really lived out very early on in a very important way, and that has really. Something that stayed with me and is still very important for me.
Thank you.
And everything else, I can just undersign what Eva said.
So it is time for us to bring our conversation to a close. But before we do, I wanted to ask if you had any closing thoughts that you'd like to share with us before we end our conversation.
Yeah, we talked about that yesterday a little bit. And I think what we would like to say as closing thoughts is that it is hard, of course, to describe life in East Germany. I mean, for people who haven't lived there, how could you realize what it was like? And so what we try to give is really just a small glimpse. There's so much more to it. But looking back, I agree, it does sound pretty scary. You know, it wasn't for us. We lived in it. It was normal life. It was normal. We didn't realize it was scary. But now when I listen to myself telling these stories, I wonder, wow, how did we do this? But despite all that, it was a good life. We had a good life. We had really good church life. We had really strong friendships. We had really good spirituality in our church, even though we had that outside environment that was so non-churchy. And we were given a chance to develop leadership skills that are hard to find in other places, I think. Maybe because the church was so small, so everybody was needed. I don't know, but it was a good time despite everything.
Thank you, Eva. And thanks to our listeners for joining us today. And a big thanks to that young woman who went to Kansas City in 1906, 1907, and started something that we now have the benefit of these both Eva and Kirsten as leaders in Community of Christ. So continuing that tradition of women's leadership. So for our listeners, we encourage you to view the lecture that Eva and Kirsten gave. It's in the archives under the Church Without Boundaries Fall Lecture Series at historicsitesfoundation.org. You can go there to see it. Did you have photographs as well in your lecture? Excellent. So another treat for our listeners, if you go and watch the lecture, you'll see the slides that were presented as well. So thank you to Eva and Kirsten for being with us today. This is Cup of Joe, part of the Project Zion podcast. I'm Karen Peter. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.